There's a lot of me that actually finds great pleasure in this part of the world, this part of America, this part of California. I spent part of yesterday afternoon driving up the Marin County coastline on Highway 1 and just thinking deeply and lingeringly about my own life, and stopped at Stinson Beach and was remembering when I was about 3 years old, those were the first waves and water I put my feet into. I was born in the mountains of Colorado. We moved to Davis, California, and I was 2 years old. And I think really the first time I went into the ocean was at Stinson Beach, and just couldn't believe really that the water could do that to my toes. So to be there again yesterday was a great gift to me. Along the way, much later in my life, I even spent one night in your infamous and famous People's Park, sleeping through the hours of the night in a sleeping bag. And it was when I dropped out of college years, and I spent a year in a commune living in Palo Alto, but often in Berkeley in that year. And it's wonderful to be back among you. So, as beautiful as the Holy Sacrament itself. Sometime around the turn of the 18th century, what would be the late 1700s, the early 1800s, the Spanish explorer Gabriel Moraga discovered and named the Sacramento Valley and the Sacramento River. A Spanish writer with the Moraga expedition wrote, quote, "Canopies of oaks and cottonwoods, many festooned with grapevines, overhung with both sides with a blue current. Birds chattered in the trees, and big fish darted through the depths of the water. The air was like champagne, and they drank deep of it, drank in the beauty around them. Es como el Sagrado Sacramento. This is like the Holy Sacrament." Well, Moraga's father, as you know, because you drive his streets, maybe you live in his town, he was the companion of Father Junipero Serra, who made his way from Baja, California to Alta, California, 250 years ago, making stop by stop along what we call now the California coastline, establishing missions as we know them now, cities which seem to be so far, far, far away, really, from a missionary expedition of the church into the new world. But eventually they made their way right across the bay, didn't they? And they established the Mission Dolores, or the mission later named San Francisco de Assis, in 1776. That we are here today is because we are heirs of this history of Christian mission in the modern world, of Spanish and European missionaries bringing the gospel of the kingdom, first to Baja, California, Lower California, then to Alta or Upper California. But of course, it wasn't only the gospel of the kingdom, was it? It was Spanish politics and economics, and it was a globalizing economy for the Spanish government and state in the 1700s, which brought them here as well. And it was a military part to the story, too, which is why Moraga came along as a lieutenant in the Spanish army to be attendant to and part of the expedition of Father Serra. Faithful and frail, earnest and stumbling, visionary and flawed, they gave themselves to a common vocation of being the salt and light of the kingdom as they traveled from south to north, establishing missions all along the coast of California. Our text for this morning are these words from Mark's Gospel, chapter 16, verse 15. "Go into the world and proclaim the gospel to the whole of creation, all of life, all of learning, all of labor." I want to offer you this morning a vision and two ways into that vision. So a vision and then two ways into that vision. Some years ago, I was asked by Prison Fellowship, whose headquarters is in the Washington, D.C. area, to come speak to their staff people on a question, which they said they'd been wondering about, and what could I say about it. The question was this: is it possible to have a contemplative life and still live in Washington, D.C.? And this strange city that it is, of course, not just the Beltway and all of its, meaningfulness. But it's, of course, a city with an escalator system going into what not is our BART system, but our metro system. And the escalator system, of course, if you know it at all, has two unmarked lanes. There's a lane for those who come from Des Moines and from Bakersfield and from, you know, Dallas, who really don't know how Washington works, but they just want to see the Capitol and all the buildings, and they not quite sure where they should go, but they should stay on the right side, you see, because that's for people who don't really know much about Washington. Those who are there all the time, of course, need to be in the left lane because they have to get to a really, really important meeting in 5 minutes or the world will not turn out. So that's my city. And the question, can we have a contemplative life and still live in Washington, D.C.? I took with me two books, both by a man named Abraham Kuyper. One was a book written about 100 years ago. He, as the prime minister of a modern nation state, the Netherlands. It was a book grown out of a series of lectures given at Princeton. The Stone Lectures, which are an annual lectureship still offered at that university. But the book was called Lectures on Calvinism. And in it, he set forth this vision of every square inch belonging to Jesus, who alone is Lord. They're the famous words of his inaugural speech at the Free University of Amsterdam, where he said there isn't a square inch of the whole of reality over which Jesus, who alone is Lord, does not declare, mine. I took that book with me as somebody who represents for us engaging the world, of living into the world, of being part of the modern world and all of its push and its shove. I need to hear Kuyper say those words. But I brought with me a second book called Near Unto God, which were written in the same years where Kuyper was prime minister, before we imagined ghost writers or complimentary writers or co-writers. He actually, as prime minister, as the leader of a modern nation state, wrote 110 times on that one phrase from Psalm 72. It is good to be near unto the Lord. Now, I've often thought if I was sentenced to a desert island, if I had five books to take with me, I would take that one, actually. Because, you see, while I learn from the desert fathers and I learn from people who spend their lives other places doing other things in quieter moments of life, because of the life I have, I need to read people and learn from people who've lived in the world, who've been part of push and shove and messiness and brokenness and somehow still have found a way to live life near unto the Lord. So Kuyper's own work, which is somehow bringing together both that of prime minister, but also a deeply pious man. Somebody engaged in the world, but a contemplative too. It seemed to me to be a good story to tell these good people at prison fellowship that morning. What Kuyper, of course, offers to all of us is a vision into a liturgical rhythm and a healthy ordering of life. Because somehow it wasn't as if he needed to leave his life to be near unto the Lord. But he was called actually to stay in his life, to be part of his world, to take up the messiness, the sausage making of contemporary politics, maybe politics in every generation, in every place. Its awfulness, its smelliness, its nastiness, and yet its importance. And somehow in the midst of all that, to say, I'm going to dig deeper now. I'm going to 110 times, Lectio Divina as it was, take these few words from the Psalms and work them out again and again and again and again, 110 times, because you see, in the middle of my life, I want to be somebody who lives near unto the Lord. Well, the Kuyper is one window into this, one way into this. Simone Weil is one, another. The activist, the philosopher. You know the story, I've told it longer other places, but in short sum, it's this. She was born Jewish in the early years of the 20th century in Paris. At age 10, told her parents, I'm a communist. It seems incredible 100 years later to say that out loud, maybe. But 100 years ago, it was quite credible for somebody like Simone, even as a 10-year-old. For the next 10 years, she took her deepening communism quite seriously. Went off to the Sorbonne to do her own philosophical study and finished the top of her class when she graduated 4 years later. Never having met a communist yet in her life, she met Trotsky that summer, though. And she found herself drawn in. Excited. Trotsky himself. Except when she spent the night with him, not the night in a sexual way, but the night listening to him, listening, learning, watching him, she found herself coming to the conclusion it was all said and done. You know, he really loves humanity, but doesn't really like people that much. And she walked away from her communism in Paris the next morning. For the next 10 years, lived her life among the proletariat, the sufferers and the groaners of France. the factory workers, the farm workers, somehow by strange, strange mercy, along the way, coming face to face with the God who had tears, was how she put it. With the God who had tears. Along the way, she wrote essays, some of them remarkably important essays, one for a very important one for an academic community that Berkeley is. It's called On the Right Use of School Studies with a View to the Love of God. It isn't a very provocative title, I suppose, but it's an awfully meaningful essay. You could find it online this afternoon if you wanted. On the Right Use of School Studies with a View to the Love of God. And in all that she says, this is the summary. She argues the fact that if we learn to pay attention to what studies actually call us into, we are beginning to do what she calls sacramental study. Sacramental study. It's a good word for this morning. Sacramental study. We begin to see where heaven and earth touch each other in the thinking through of the questions of physics, in the questions of history, the questions of mathematics, the questions of literature and philosophy, and on and on and on. We begin to see where heaven and earth meet each other, and it begins to be what she calls sacramental study. You see, there are implications here for all of us in our own vocations as they are, seeing all of learning, all of labor as sacramental. My father was a University of California scientist, and much I could say about him here. I said more on Friday night. But right now, I will simply say this. As an adolescent, I began to watch and listen more carefully. And when he told me one night that he would actually did his best day by day, praying in the morning before he went off to his laboratory, wanting to have insight into his work, that he would see in and through the lenses of his microscope into the questions of his own discipline, to see connections in what he was understanding and thinking through, beginning to try to put together the universe God had given him to understand as a scientist. When I began to understand and listen to Simone Weil along the way, I looked back at my father and thought, you know, Dad, you were doing sacramental work, weren't you? It was really a sacramental study you took up, didn't you? Trying to understand the nature of verticillium wilt, which was his own special interest. My father's prayer, of course, wasn't to take him out of the world. It was to take him more deeply into the world, to understand the world and his own responsibility for it. Well, another window into this is from a man named Leslie Newbegin. Leslie Newbegin, dead now for probably 15 years, but a Scot who went to school at Cambridge, spent 40 years in India, was one of the founders of the Church of South India along the way. Spent his years actually walking into the Hindu temples of India, listening to people, talking to gurus, to scholars, thinking with them, reading their holy texts, but then saying, would you read this one with me too? There's a wonderful commentary in the Gospel of John called The Light Has Come, which is really Newbegin's own account of his years with Hindu scholars and him listening to them, but saying, but here's this too. Here's this too. It's his own reflection on what it meant to take up a life of learning with people who didn't believe what he believed, not becoming a syncretist along the way, not saying, well, you see, in the end, all ways really lead to. That was a million miles from where he was in his life. But he said, I want to listen to you carefully, but then I want you to read my text too. In his book, The Gospel in a Pluralist Society, he tells about one of these Hindu scholars who years later said to him, you know, I finally read your Bible. Your holy book. He says it's a completely unique book. It's unique in its argument that history makes sense from beginning to end. It has a story it tells from the beginning of the world to the end of the world. But he says it's also unique in its understanding of the human being as a responsible actor in history. I confess to you, when I first read those words in that book, I had literal chills down my spine thinking, how did you, the Hindu scholar, see this so clearly? When most Christians don't see it that way at all. We don't really understand why it would possibly be, in terms of world religions, world ways of making sense of life in the world, to say, you see, the scriptures really are unique in the world. They are set apart in the whole world for these reasons. Some years later, I got to know Newbegin. I asked him the question, well, who was this man? Who was he? He said, well, we've been friends for 30 years, really. And we saw each other, we would just step right back into it, into the deeper conversations. I had a deeper conversation in my own life related to Newbegin. In his mid-80s, he had moved from his home in Birmingham, England, back to London. His wife was getting ill, and they needed to take care of their children to help them in their life together. But I had his phone number, and I was asking him to come back to give a lecture here in the U.S. And I called the house, the number, and nope, it wasn't an 85-year-old man answering. I said, well, do you know where Bishop Mubigin is? And he said, well, this is his house, this is his number, but he's moved to London, and told me the story. And I think I have his number, he said. And so he went off to get it and came back and gave it to me. And I had this, I don't know, I just said, do you know who this man is? And there was a little silence on the phone. He said, well, I never heard of him before moving into his house, but a neighbor gave me a book of his to read, and I've been reading it. And he said, I'm 50 years old. And all of a sudden, we were into our own deep conversation about the deepest things of the universe and of your life and mine. And he said, I've been reading his book now for a while. I'm 50. I'm an evolutionary materialist. And I'm beginning to think these questions through for the first time in my life. And I'm beginning to see, in fact, that if he's right in his critique of the modern world, then in fact, I have no basis for meaning, do I? I called Mubigin later that day and said, you know, we should pray for this man, actually. He's on his way. I hope sometime, somewhere, I'll meet him. Taken together, Simone Weil and Leslie Mubigin are our teachers. They're guides for us in our own vocations in the world, helping us to see that everything is to be sacramental, holy to the Lord, and at the heart of every calling is that we enter into the world that is there, a secularizing, pluralizing, globalizing world that it is, with a proper confidence that God is there and that He has spoken. Well, a last word for this morning. Why is it that preaching and praying matter to and for the whole creation? Strange words they are, aren't they, in Mark's gospel? Preach the gospel to the whole creation. We think, well, did you miss that part? Wouldn't it have been to every little boy and every little girl and every man and every woman? But the whole creation? What is it about Mark's reading of the task of Jesus, the work of God in the world, that says the whole creation, the whole gospel for the whole creation? I have for years asked musicians this question. Can you sing songs shaped by the truest truths of the universe in language the whole world can understand? Can you sing songs shaped by the truest truths of the universe in language the whole world can understand? You are a congregation, not thousands of them, but some of them around the world, which have been graced by the ministry of John Stott over the years. And if you remember one of his best books, out of many, very, many, many good books, of course, one called Between Two Worlds, about the task of preaching in the world. He talked about it being between the ancient world and the contemporary, between the world of thousands of years ago and this moment of the year 2014. How do we somehow live stretched taut between these two worlds and offer a word from the Lord? When I walked in Friday night, of course, I was listening, as all of us were who were here, to U2's music, which seemed glorious and right to me. This past week, of course, just across the bay, who was there but Bono and his boys, you know, right alongside Apple introducing their new iPhone. You know, a great, great moment in the history of the world, right? Well, I've been at U2 concerts, maybe some of you have too, and stood beside a man named Father Jack, who's an Anglican rector. Been a friend of these boys, these now men, since they were 17-year-olds. And Jack is an Anglican ordained pastor who has traveled with the group U2 for years and years and years, preaching, praying, thinking, reading the scriptures with them day by day, concert by concert, walking into the venues of the world, the great stadiums and arenas of the world, and actually praying before it all happens, walking around in a wonderfully rich and important, almost, you know, Pentecostal way for a great work of the Holy Spirit to be done that night when the music begins to play. Did you know that? I watched him one night during a concert night, and I said, what are you doing, Jack? And he said, well, I'm just trying to gauge the spiritual responsiveness of the crowd tonight, the thousands, the scores of thousands who were there, to see how they're responding spiritually to the set play we've put together for the concert tonight. Did you know they prayed through the songs they sing night by night? If you went onto the internet this afternoon, onto YouTube, you could actually get a prayer from Father Jack Heaslip, H-E-A-S-L-I-P. Father Jack Heaslip, and it's the beginning of the last tour. And Bono says, Father Jack's going to pray for us before we start the tour tonight. And it is the most sacramental and all-of-life prayer I've ever heard in my life. He not only prays, of course, you know, for the guys who play the music. They're almost the last on the list. But he prays for those who drive one of the 200 semi-vans it takes to get a U2 concert from city to city. He prays for the people who lay the cable. He even prays for the cable itself of all things. He is praying into and, of course, preaching to the whole of creation in that prayer. And it's instructive for all of us. Saint Francis de Assis, Francis of Assisi, he sometimes said to have said these words, "Preach the gospel at all times, and when necessary, use words." Well, it's not quite a quote, actually. He didn't really ever say those words. But he said something close, and it was these words: "No brother should preach contrary to the form and regulations of the Holy Church, nor unless he's been permitted by his minister. All the friars should preach by their deeds." All the friars should preach by their deeds. If there's any lingering reality to the story of St. Francis, hearing it as we do almost 1,000 years later, holding anything that we hold on to with historical grounding, we know that he was known for his authenticity, for his simplicity, for his determination that words become flesh, for his commitment to loving God and loving the world around him, its people, its problems, its birds, its bees, its flowers, and its trees. He gave himself to the very world that was his, knowing that in the most important way, it was God's world too. What is there in this story for us? For people gathered together at the First Presbyterian Church of Berkeley, California, a city on a hill as it is, looking out as it does on another city on another hill, the city that remembers St. Francis as it does in his very own name. Other than that, we are to be people of honesty and integrity, people who take into our hearts the hopes and sorrows of the world, complex and perplexing as they are, seeing that that is the vocation of God himself, the God who has tears, as Simone Weil came to see. And in and through that, we find our own vocation, of course. So, brothers and sisters, it's into the neighborhoods, the city, the schools, the businesses, the university, the Bay Area and beyond, remembering that every square inch belongs to Jesus, who alone is Lord. Every square inch, which is why we need a liturgical vision for a life that nourishes all of life, our learning, our labor, our love. A sacramental vision it must be, weaving together our worship and our work, our praying and our thinking, our learning and our living. That is the word of the Lord in the Gospel of Mark. Amen.